From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rubin, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, evangelicals overwhelmingly back President Trump in 2016 and remain among his most loyal followers. Prominent pastors offer frequent public praise. This raises a troubling issue. Are Christian conservatives putting politics above religion? Are pastors more interested in becoming political players? And is any of this good for religious life in America? That's coming up on 1 year later after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post. We're talking today about the odd alliance between the Christian evangelical community and President Trump. Here to discuss that with us is Peter Wehner, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a contributing op-ed writer at The New York Times. He worked in the administrations of of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you, Jen?
It's great to have you here. Also with me is Robert P. Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, and author of what I think is the best book on the topic, not only of Christian America, but of Donald Trump's constituency, and that is The End of White Christian America. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Robert, in your book, you note that we have now passed the point at which white Protestant Americans are a minority in our society. How did that affect them, and how does that play into the narrative, really, of the entire Trump presidency?
Well, I should first say that I wrote the book well before Trump was even a candidate, much less, closing in on securing the presidency. But what drew me to it was the dramatic demographic changes, and not only in terms of race and ethnicity, but in terms of religion in the country. And that when you put those two things together, something quite dramatic became clear, and that is that we had moved from being a majority white Christian country just 10 years ago, when Barack Obama was first running for president, for example, the country was 54% white, non-Hispanic, and Christian. If you put all kinds of Christians together, Protestant, Catholic, non-denominational, Orthodox, et cetera, 54% of the country. You take it forward to this election cycle, so just 8 years later, and that number has dropped to 43%. So just in this kind of under a decade moment during the Obama presidency, we have really crossed this milestone. And I think this movement from a country that was, majority white and Christian to minority white and Christian, while we have our first African-American president, it did set off, I think, some alarm bells, I think, with particularly conservative white Christians, in feeling like the country was changing in many ways beyond recognition. I should say, you were just talking about the Master Pete case. The other thing that changed a lot in this period was gay rights and American support for gay rights. So again, if we use that same time period, we also went from a country where only 4 in 10 Americans supported same-sex marriage, for example, to a country where more than 6 in 10 supported same-sex marriage during that same time period I'm describing just in the last decade. So that issue flipped on its head. And I think that cultural signal plus the demographic and religious changes, I think, really did set off a sense of cultural anxiety and vertigo in many ways among particularly conservative Christians who had been kind of all in opposing same-sex marriage, for example, in terms of politics, and had this sense that, the old terms like the moral majority, for example, that there was a kernel of truth to that, and saw themselves at the center of American politics in a way, and cultural values in a way that they no longer really did.
Right. Peter, despite this sense of cultural ennui, if you will, it's still a little hard to understand how faith leaders could get behind someone like Donald Trump. You and I have talked about that a lot this year. What is the conclusion that you've reached about these pastors and their relationship with Donald Trump?
Well, I think that what they've done essentially is to subordinate their Christian faith to their political and ideological alliances and beliefs. And I think that they've engaged in a massive case of confirmation bias and attempted to justify something that's ultimately not justifiable. I put in the caveat that a lot of evangelical Christians I know, A, don't support Donald Trump, and B, some
right.
many do, who do it reluctantly. But I think you've zeroed in on the key point, and the one that really troubles me and pains me the most, and that are these prominent Christian evangelical leaders, people like Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell Jr., Eric Metaxas, Robert Jeffress, and others, who not only support him, but are essentially his courtiers. They are the most obsequious of the Trump supporters, and will defend him no matter what, and not utter a word of criticism. And I think that's deeply troubling. I think it's hypocritical. And I think that it shows that what they were looking for was something very much different than they advertised. My hunch, and I thought the answer that was given was very, very good about the cultural anxiety and vertigo and a sense of fear, which I think has given way to anger. But the other thing that I heard a lot of from evangelical friends of mine who supported Donald Trump is that he's a fighter. And that plays into this. They feel that they've gone from being a moral majority to a besieged minority, and they felt like Donald Trump would fight on their behalf. They were angry and frustrated with what they thought was too much weakness from past Republicans. There's a lot of grievance among a lot of white evangelicals, as well as fear, and they felt like Donald Trump embodied it. I think that is a massive mistake. I think ultimately it will do a great deal to discredit the Christian faith, but they are where they are.
That's Pete Wehner. We're talking about evangelicals in the age of Trump. We've invited listeners to leave voicemails to talk about how the Trump presidency has affected their lives. Here's Ben Ferguson. He was raised evangelical and now lives in Salt Lake City.
Trump's election changed my life, and it did so by really changing my relationship with my parents. All my life, I viewed my parents through rose-colored glasses. All of their decisions and advice, I didn't take the same skepticism towards it. And learning they voted for Donald Trump, I really got those glasses knocked off. It changed the way I viewed my relationship with church and the church they raised me in. Because it seems like for a religion that preaches a lot about forgiveness and love, most of its members are motivated by fear and hate. And it changed the way that I interact with my parents. They live in Colorado, so we have to talk on the phone. And before anytime I would see their name come on caller ID, I would pick it up right away. But now I pause. I have to prepare myself to speak with my parents now. And it's been really, really difficult. I don't know how to reconcile the fact that my parents taught me things like blessed are the meek and blessed are the poor in spirit, and then voted for the exact opposite of those values in flesh.
That's a very telling and very poignant, really, self-confession there. I want to bring in my third guest, Mark Galley. He is editor-in-chief of Christianity Today. Hello, Mark.
Hey, good to be with you.
Nice. Thank you. What's your reaction to Ben? That was a very poignant tale that he told of really the separation from parents and maybe even from his faith-based religion and upbringing.
Yeah, no, it was very poignant. And that's been the experience of a lot of people, not just with their parents, but with other relatives or people close to them. They just don't understand how evangelicals can seemingly compromise their faith and moral commitments for the sake of political gain. The one thing that I try to bring back into this conversation time and again is that this in one sense, is not that unusual. That is to say, when people get close to political power, they're very tempted. We're all very tempted, and I can say that personally, to sacrifice some of our principles to gain that power. Religious people don't seem to have a track record of actually being more moral than people who are not religious in this respect. We saw it recently in the last few years in Turkey, where a conservative moral Muslim conservative takeover of the government on moral principles was soon thwarted itself by practicing the very immoral practices that this previous government had been doing. So it's less, to me, the issue is that we somehow imagine that evangelicals are going to be more moral than most people, but in fact they're just people like everybody else. And so when they get close to power and they have a chance to gain power, they'll do a lot of things to get it. Now, we should say they're not just interested in power in and of itself. They might be, like all of us are, but they also have these principles that they're really striving for. One of them would be, for example, the pro-life cause. They believe that by supporting a candidate like Donald Trump or Roy Moore, that they will actually save human lives. Whether that will actually happen or not, I don't know. But a lot of them believe it, and that's why they're able to make those trade-offs in their mind.
I'm here talking about religion and the association of the Christian right with Donald Trump and his movement. I have as my guests Mark Galley, Peter Wehner, and Robert P. Jones. Pete, before we listened to the clip, we were talking about fighting and fighting for what, which does come back to what Mark was just talking about, that they feel like they have principles that they are fighting for. What's wrong with that, or what's right with that? They want certain things, whether it's in the pro-life movement, whether it's in the marriage arena, whether it's in religious liberty, and so they support this guy. What's the difficulty there?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate argument, and the truth is that in my conversations with evangelicals, I understood people who voted for Donald Trump reluctantly because they felt like he was pushing an agenda that they felt would do more good for the common good, for the moral good. The pro-life was one issue, the judges more broadly were others. And so I think that is a reasonable argument. It's one I ultimately disagreed with. Again, I think the key thing that has happened is that they have given up their intellectual, and a lot of them have given up their intellectual and moral honesty in the process. So what they've done is, in attaching themselves to Trump and the Trump agenda, they've gone sotto voce when Trump transgresses certain moral lines. And so they are not speaking out against him or against Roy Moore. In fact, they are the most reliable supporters of Trump and Moore in virtually every circumstance, and that I think is what's really the most damning indictment against them.
Right.
Beyond that, you know, my own criticisms of Donald Trump were in part moral, but they really went deeper than that. And I understand why this wouldn't be first among equals for evangelical voters, but I think it should have entered into the calculation, which is that it isn't simply that Donald Trump is an imperfect moral vehicle. He's a vastly flawed intellectual vehicle as well. That is, he's a man of staggering ignorance. He has no real deep beliefs, and beyond all of that, he is a person with a disordered personality. He is not psychologically or emotionally stable, and getting that kind of person power of the presidency is taking an enormous risk. And again, I think that evangelicals, and not only evangelicals, have blinded themselves to it and have somehow rallied themselves behind Trump. I think Mark makes a very, very good point and an appropriately humble point that all of us face the temptations of power. But he said, you know, that evangelicals are people just like everyone else, and I understand that. We're all flawed and broken. On the other hand, he knows, as I know, as an evangelical, that we are, as a matter of faith, supposed to be people on a path to having our minds and hearts transformed. And there is no Christian distinctive now when it comes to Christians in politics. And that is really an indictment against people who pronounce that faith. That if evangelicals are just like any other special interest group, then you've lost the point of what it means to be salt and light in the world.
Right. That's Peter Wehner. Robert, that gets back to something that you've looked at in your book. If pastors become political players, if they give up those powers of Christian discernment, do they contribute to the disillusionment with organized religion and further erode their flock?
You know, what's notable, I mean, it certainly is the case that, you know, pastors have leadership duties. And, you know, what I found about this last election cycle is that if you had listened to the people who talk on shows like this, you know, kind of the evangelical elite, I think you would have thought it was maybe an even fight. You know, there were people like Russell Moore from the Southern Baptist Convention and others who were very outspoken and, you know, could even put themselves in kind of a never Trump and were saying things like, look, if this is what it means to be an evangelical, I'm going to stop using the term even. So very strong statements. You know, then you had people like Robert Jeffries on the other side. But it looked like more of a fair fight. But, you know, when it came down to the wire, and we look, you know, we look at the exit polls, I mean, what you see is over 8 in 10, 81% of white evangelical rank and file folks walked to the polls and pulled the lever for Donald Trump. We just released some new data today looking at Donald Trump's favorability, and it's only 41% in the country in our latest data. But among white evangelical Protestants, his job favorability is 72%. And we asked a follow-up. We asked a follow-up question, too, just, because we wanted to know just how strong that was. And so we asked everyone who had a favorable view of Trump whether there was anything he could do that might make them change their mind and not, you know, have a favorable view of his job performance as president. 30% of white evangelicals say so it's overall 72% who have a favorable view. 30% of them say there's virtually nothing he could do to lose their support.
We're going to have to leave it right there for a moment, Robert. That's a sobering statistic. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more on evangelicals in the Trump era. This is 1 year later from KCRW. We're back. I'm Jennifer Rubin, and this is 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, I'm talking about the evangelical community's rock-solid support for Donald Trump. My guests are Peter Wehner, Robert Jones, and Mark Galley. Let me turn to how politics affects religion and religion affects politics. Peter, are the politicians using religious leaders in ways that diminish our politics? Are they hurting their own causes in some way when they try to use religious validation for their positions?
Yeah, I think in this instance that they are. I mean, I don't think that's always the case. I'm somebody who believes that religious faith has often, within history, been a driving force for social good. I mean, you can see the anti-slavery movement and the anti-segregation movement are two obvious examples. But in this case, I think that that they are, because I think what it looks like is an alliance of unprincipled convenience between the political power brokers and religious leaders. I think that people of religious faith who are such stalwart advocates for Donald Trump are hurting themselves and their faith more than politics. But I think politics is being injured, too, because I think it's helping to contribute to cynicism. And I think one of the real problems that we have in American life today is this pervading cynicism about almost everything, but an awful lot about politics. Some of it is warranted, but some of it is not. And in the end, you can't have that over a prolonged period of time, because politics is finally and fundamentally about justice. It's an imperfect and limited way to advance justice, but that's what it should be about. And if you undermine that vision of the moral good of politics, which I think is happening now, I think that hurts politics. I think it hurts the country.
It should also be said, I think, that one of the innovations, the achievements of American political society, was that we didn't make political arguments into religious arguments, for which there were bloody, bloody wars in Europe for centuries, and it's still continuing to some extent into today. Mark, looking at the flip side of that, are politics and the over-reliance on politics hurting religiosity in America?
I would say so, yeah. because of the temptation I said earlier. When you get involved in politics is about shaping the public life to gain ends that you think are best for public life. It's about using power. And in a democracy, it's about using power appropriately, but it's nonetheless about using power. And as we can see from the example of the Muslims I gave in Turkey, you could do dozens of examples in the whole world, but it's now among evangelicals. What it does is it tends to confuse our thinking quite a bit when we are trying to gain political power, even if they're for great ends. We end up acting like anyone who gets involved in politics. I mean, there have been occasions when, for example, the mainline church back in the 60s compromised a lot of its values in order to have a place at the American political table. That was a common criticism of evangelicals of the mainline back in the 60s and 70s, and now we're doing it. So it's just a problem. This doesn't mean that Christians shouldn't be involved in politics, but it just seems to me we should be a lot more wary of making sweeping statements, announcements, pronouncements, and moral judgments, and should approach the whole thing with just a great deal more humility.
We're talking religion and Donald Trump. Robert, who heads the Public Research Religion Research Institute and does phenomenal polling, Robert, one of the things that you looked at in an earlier poll was how different groups of America look at others' misfortune, whether they think, for example, African Americans are discriminated against, or whether they think Hispanics are discriminated against. You also looked at who was more concerned about gays and lesbians being denied service, much like the Supreme Court case that's going on. One of the things that you saw across the board was that evangelicals seem less inclined to be empathetic towards their fellow Americans and more willing, for example, to deny services to the LGBT community. That seems to be the opposite of what you would expect from a religious community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, it's right. So we've asked both kind of a general form of the question about, you know, the denial of services based on religious reasons, which is what this Masterpiece case case that's before the kind of opening before the Supreme Court today is all about. And I also asked it specifically in the context of kind of wedding cakes and florists, which is a kind of more specific instance of this kind of broader question. But, you know, what has happened, I think, is that white evangelical Protestants, and I want to be careful to say white evangelical Protestants here, actually have come to a place where they really stand alone in the American religious landscape today on many of these issues around sexuality, particularly around gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights. And so, for example, our latest data about whether with wedding-based kind of business owner who provides wedding services such as flowers or wedding cakes should be allowed to refuse to provide those services based on their religious beliefs. White evangelical Protestants are the only religious group in the country for whom a majority say they should be allowed to refuse to provide those services. Two-thirds of them say they should refuse to provide those services. And what's notable about it is when you look across the religious landscape, it's religious minorities, so non-Christian religious groups, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, who are strongly opposed. They're actually mirror opposites. But it's also racial and ethnic minorities, so African-American Protestants and Hispanic Catholics, who both strongly oppose allowing businesses to do this. And so I think what you've got, again, is this sense of among white evangelicals, it's about holding on to a kind of cultural dominance that they once had in the country previously and not that long ago agreed with them on many of these issues. Now they find themselves on the minority side of the issue. But it's not just kind of a religious secular thing. All other religious groups have actually moved on this issue. And, you know, a surprising number, for example, African-American Protestants, 56% opposed, but Hispanic Catholics, 73% opposed allowing businesses to do this. And so I think it comes down to, you know, are you thinking about cakes or lunch counters? Are you thinking about liberty? Or are you thinking about discrimination? And for many religious minorities and ethnic minorities, I think they're hearing the second part of those terms. It, you know, this You're talking about a limiting principle. Where does it stop? Can you refuse to serve, Muslims? Can you refuse to serve African Americans or Jews if you disagree with those on religious grounds? And I think what's notable is that it's white evangelicals that are really holding out this place all on their own now, and where the rest of religious Americans have really moved the other direction toward more an open and accepting position.
We're talking religion and the Trump administration specifically about the relationship with between the evangelical community and President Trump. Peter, it seems that if you're convinced that you are a victim, as many Christian conservatives do, that you've been at the top of the heap and now something has been taken away from you, and you therefore think, woe is me, that it's perhaps harder then to be empathetic, to see real discrimination in other groups. Is that something that Donald Trump masterfully tapped into during the election?
Yeah, I think he did. I think that he was able to touch onto these cores of resentment and grievance, and as we've been talking about, the sense of lost influence and of lost power, which has created, I think, a lot of anxiety and fear, which has transmuted into anger. And so I think that white evangelicals feel like that they're losing the world that they once knew. And indeed, their rhetoric really echoes that. If you listen to people from like Franklin Graham and others, they use language which is apocalyptic. And they really spoke as if the entire American effort and enterprise depended on this one election. And they viewed Donald Trump as the person who would, in a sense, save the country. I do just want to inject a point of theology, I guess, in this conversation, because it's relevant, obviously, if the topic is evangelical Christians, which is, if you look at the history of the Christian church, when it has had the greatest impact and the greatest witness and the greatest expansion in terms of its acceptance and its growth, it hasn't been times of cultural and political strength, but quite the opposite. It's often been when it's been facing times of persecution and hardship. And Rodney Stark, the historian, has written about how the Christian church flourished in their first couple of centuries, because what were they known for? Their empathy, their compassion, caring for orphans and children who were suffering, and people who were being their lives broken by disease, and so forth. That was the great Christian witness that brought people to the faith, because they saw transformed lives. And a lot of Christians today, particularly evangelical Christians, I think, believe that power is really what we have to achieve, and if we lose power, we lose everything. And that simply is not only not correct, it's pretty much antithetical to a Christian worldview.
Well, as a historical matter, speaking on behalf of Jews, I can say that being a repressed minority does have its benefits. It does create a solidarity, a willingness to give up things of the world for things of faith. A real irony, I suppose, in political and religious relations. Mark, do you think there's a crisis now in Christian conservatism? They've reached the pinnacle of power, if you will, because they have Donald Trump. But do you think that they're suffering either a diminution in moral authority or perhaps risk losing a great number of their adherents?
Yes and yes, probably. Anytime you... Well, I hate to keep harping on the same theme because your questions seem to direct it in that direction. So I think that for the short-term gain, let's just be charitable and assume that evangelicals are supporting Donald Trump because they want greater religious freedom, which I think is a legitimate cause. They want to save the life of the unborn. That's a legitimate cause. They want more jobs for their community that have been lost in the economy, legitimate concerns. But they're supporting a candidate who is, or a president now, who is a train wreck morally, psychologically, and maybe even probably politically in a lot of ways. And they may win short-term gains. They've already won some short-term games. They got a Supreme Court justice they like. They've won some religious liberty issues. I don't know how the court case is going to end up today, but things are moving in their direction. But I think people will perceive, since what they're gaining this political advantage, having compromised some of their moral principles, I don't think the gains will have any long-term stability. What we want, it seems to me, as a pro-life Christian myself, is I would like our culture's attitude, like on life in the womb, to change, like our attitudes, culture toward sexual harassment or racism has changed over the decades, so that it's just unthinkable that you'd think any other way about such issues. But if we strive to win it simply by pulling the levers of political power, all the while compromising many of our own moral principles, that's just gonna backfire in ways that are hardly imaginable.
Right. In our last minute together, Robert, it seems that this happens at a time when, as Pete says, we're such a broken society. There's great suffering, there's poverty, there's great income inequality. Is it possible that there are some or maybe a majority of evangelicals who would redirect their activity towards a religious cause as opposed to a political cause, to helping their fellow man be happy, healthier, more prosperous? Do you think that's a possibility for the movement?
Well, I wouldn't be optimistic about that, I have to say. Looking at the data, there's I think one of the challenges, and there's always been this kind of great divide between in the white evangelical community between service things, which they're doing. So some of the most, well-organized disaster relief, for example, comes out of the Southern Baptist Convention and other evangelical entities, so in response to hurricanes and other kinds of things. So that's going on. That's happening. But it's also happening at the same time where these communities are supporting a candidate that, by all those principles, really, I think, doesn't quite stack up. And I'll end with this because I think it's one of the most poignant things about political ethics, and this is really what we're talking about, kind of how do you apply your faith to politics? And there is typically, I think what makes evangelicals different from just people is that they were very vocal about being values voters, right? That they had this political ethic, that there was a set of values that they were going to put out there. They were going to measure every candidate by these values and let the chips fall where they may. And yet, we can even see it in the data. So in 5 years ago, we asked a question about we said, can a political candidate who has committed immoral acts in their private life still behave ethically and perform their duties in their public life? Only about 3 in 10 evangelicals agree with that 5 years ago. We asked it again in the context of the 2016 election, and now 72% of white evangelicals agree with that statement. The only difference is that Donald Trump is at the top of the ticket. So right. Evangelicals have actually just completely turned their political ethics
on its
head.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Yep.
We're going to have to leave it there, Robert. Thanks to all my guests, Peter Wehner, Robert Jones, and Mark Galley. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with 1 Year Later from KCRW. I'm Jennifer Rubin, back with 1 Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show when we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the right, we're bringing in Naira Huck. She is a longtime communications advisor in government and a former State Department senior advisor. She joins us from the left. Welcome.
Hello, Jennifer. Good to be with you.
Nice to be with you. Naira and I often run into one another in the green room at MSNBC, which is a telling, incident of the times. Today we had an extraordinary event, a long-term Congressman John Conyers stepping down. Let's listen to what he had to say.
My legacy can't be compromised or diminished in any way by what we're going through now. This too shall pass.
That was John Conyers talking about his legacy, not wanting to be besmirched by allegations of sexual abuse, sexual harassment. How big a deal is this, Naira?
I think it's a very big deal, and it's been a reckoning that's been coming for a long time. I think you and I have both had discussions about that the treatment of women should not be a partisan issue. We should be able to rise above that and have a basic standard of decency that applies across the board, regardless of political party. And I just am ashamed to say that, having worked on the Hill I was well aware that John Conyers had a wandering eye, made women uncomfortable, and in fact had married an intern that he courted in his own office. So there is a history and a pattern of behavior here that people who work near him are well aware of. The unfortunate thing is putting this in the broader context of who's going first and who's leaving Congress first. It's hard to say that John Conyers is the worst of the people who's on people on Capitol Hill who prey on women, and there's a tone here that I think people are wary of. And putting this in the context of the racial dynamics, John Conyers is the last person who was endorsed by Martin Luther King Jr. He is largely responsible for pushing through many of the civil rights, important civil rights acts and movements into policy and making them into law coming out of the 60s. So it's an unfortunate aspect of his legacy that he will now be known for having been treating women poorly. And I know from my experience there are people who have behaved worse than he has. So I think it's time for the dominoes to start falling.
It was just a week or so ago that Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, former Speaker of the House, was calling him an icon. And then just a day or so ago, she said it was time to step down. What happened, do you think, within the Democratic Party or within the House caucus for the shift to transpire?
I think it was a wrestling with the public dynamic and the cultural moment we're all in. And I'll be the first one to say, our leaders in Congress are often a step or two behind the times of how their constituents are feeling about an issue. And I think it is some of that, having been a colleague and worked with him for so many years. It's complicated when somebody that you love and admire in many ways has some really fatal character flaws. And that's something we're all wrestling with as we hear about different leaders falling from grace. And so I think it's a very natural reaction, but I also think it was a much overdue. I just wish that John Conyers had seen the writing on the wall and taken this step to move out of office much sooner than he did. It just ended up being a distraction, not only from the issues that are confronting Congress right now, particularly the tax bill, as it was last week, but also from his own legacy and the good work that he had done.
Right. There's also Al Franken, who may now be under greater pressure to resign because of John Conyers' step. But in some ways, the Democratic Party here has done what we expect political leaders to do. They've taken that zero tolerance stance. They pressured, frankly, John Conyers to leave. Al Franken is facing a ethics investigation. Is the Democratic Party, in some sense, going to make hay out of this, that they're the party that does not tolerate sexual predators? And the Republicans have, first of all, Donald Trump sitting atop their party, who was accused by multiple women of sexual assault. And then, of course, Roy Moore, who has been accused of sexual predation against children. Is this becoming a political divide because the Republicans can't escape from Donald Trump and Roy Moore?
Well, they can escape from Roy Moore. It's pretty straightforward. Don't endorse the man. Disavow his behavior and disavow that he deserves a spot in the Senate. I mean, he's running against a man who, this is a sexual predator running against a man who has built his career on prosecuting Ku Klux Klan members who terrorized Black people in Alabama in the 60s. So could not
Who's the Democratic opponent there in Alabama.
You could not have more of a contrast on the moral spectrum of these with these two candidates, and instead people are choosing to view it strictly along partisan lines. I think it'll be a very interesting case study for how people, particularly Christian evangelicals, make their decisions and what that does for the long-term credibility of the GOP in particularly red states like Alabama. So it shouldn't be a partisan issue. I don't think the Democrats, frankly, need to make hay because it is pretty obvious on its face that there is now one party that is holding people accountable for bad behavior towards women and, frankly, for being sexual predators, and another party that is not. I mean, that's not, that is simply a matter of fact at this point.
Right. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the Russia investigation. The president's lawyer this week said Trump can't commit obstruction of justice because he's the president. I thought we got rid of this during the Richard Nixon administration when he, after all, was indicted, was not indicted. He was an unindicted co-conspirator. What's happened here? Is his lawyer just wrong?
Well, I think his lawyer is going to do whatever he can to protect his boss, even if it means writing tweets that he then has to disavow. So it does signal that the legal team surrounding Donald Trump and his family are scrambling and that they are worried. There is a legal argument to be made about whether or not the president can be prosecuted while he is in office. We certainly know that after he leaves office, he can be prosecuted for obstruction of justice, particularly if it's a criminal offense. So there are legal arguments there, but on its face, socially and culturally and politically, it just continues this perception and idea that Donald Trump wants to hold himself above and separate from the law. In the same 48-hour period, while saying that Donald Trump is above being charged for obstruction of justice, they were calling the FBI an organization in tatters. I mean, this is direct attacks on the integrity of our law enforcement institutions. So this is a broader pattern of behavior that, frankly, we are used to seeing from dictators and autocrats, not from democratically elected leaders in our own country.
All right. Well, there was also news this week that Robert Mueller, who's the special counsel, has subpoenaed Donald Trump's bank records from Deutsche Bank, and Deutsche Bank is going to cooperate. Could this be a red line? Remember that Trump said that if the special prosecutor went after his personal financial affairs, that would be a step too far. Do you think we're reaching a crisis point where he might turn around to fire Mueller?
So the firing Mueller would be particularly, so it certainly would trigger some sort of constitutional crisis, and we'll see how Congress decides that they need to step in. The subpoena of the Deutsche Bank records is interesting in particular with the history of this bank. This is a bank that has paid British and U.S. regulators about $670 million in penalties for money laundering specifically for Russians. And there has been some supposition and discussion that Trump entities, while not directly ensconced in Moscow, like there's no Trump Tower there, even though Trump's lawyers have said that they've tried at one point to pursue real estate in Moscow. So it's not direct holdings in Russia. But there is a perception and perhaps evidence, I think is what they're looking for, and that Trump entities are the terminus. They are the endpoint for money laundering from Russia. And we do know that Trump has had extensive social and on the outskirts business relationships with people in Russia. That will be the subject of the upcoming conversations Donald Trump Jr. is going to have with House Intelligence Committees. For Trump to say that this is a bridge too far, not sure that he has much leverage at this point to prevent congressional investigations and Robert Mueller from getting to the truth.
Right. Well, thank you very much. That was Naira Huck joining us for Talk It Out. That's it for today on One Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for a show on young Republicans and millennials. We leave you with Mahalia Jackson. He's got the whole world in his hands. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International.
He's got everybody here. Right in his hand, he's got everybody here. Right in his hand, he's got everybody. Was a thing money could buy, the whole wide world in his hand. The rich would live and the poor would die, the whole wide world in his hand. So glad he's got the whole world. Right in his hand, he's got the whole.
Public Guild. International.